Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we help enlighten the world around us and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone. And now your host, internationally renowned spiritual intuit, medium, channel, author, artist, lecturer, and ordained minister, Ms. Barbara DeLong.
Thank you, Ken, and hello and welcome everybody to Nightlight. That was the magical voice of Ken Quiet Hawk inviting you to come in out of the mainstream and join us for a time to be sheltered from the storms of evolution and change, that which we laughingly call creation. Come and join in with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and hopefully wisdom. These are times of change, times that call to the seekers, and you answer that call from all walks of life, from countless aspects of the spiritual realms. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading your wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. We all come from different backgrounds and modalities from all walks of life, and yet there is a synchronicity, a commonality that draws and blends us together, weaving us once more into a collective purpose, a common direction, and a united family once again. We go by different titles, labels, names, if you will. We call ourselves watchers, wardens, indigos, soothsayers, mystics, questers, and querents, journeyers and light workers, light bearers, spiritual empaths. And that name, that list, it goes on and on and on forever. It is as unique and eclectic as are we. Yet we all have the same spiritual calling, and we all in our own very individual ways bring light into this reality to facilitate the awakening and the shifting of the consciousness of mankind. This is my own very private oasis in the turmoil we call evolution, so sit back, take a break, share your lights with us, and join in the love, the light, and the laughter that spiritual energy always generates when lights are blended and spirits lifted. I'm Barb DeLong, your host, and along with Jeannie and Chris from Curious Times, we welcome you in and hope you'll add your lights to ours to increase the energy and brighten all of our own personal lights. We will be doing readings at some point in time if you want one. The number is 347-857-2139. Jeannie's in the chat room, so if you have any questions, she's the one you aim at. Ken Quiet Hawk can be found at nativestorytellers.com if you want to learn more about that amazing voice. I'm at barbaradelong.com, and our special guest tonight, Chris, can be found every night from 10 to 12 Eastern on Curious Times, an amazing show you want to really make sure you check out because it is as unique as she is. Before we get involved with the readings, though, I want to share with you some very special shows that I highly recommend to those seeking spiritual surroundings. With so many shows here on Blog Talk, sometimes it's hard to decide where you want to share your time and invest yourself. These are shows I love and frequent often because of the quality of the material and the spiritual energy that they radiate. Monday through Thursday on the Wolf and Bear Network, you'll find the most magical way for starting your day with Morning Blessings with Bear Medicine Walker. That's at 10 a.m. Eastern. Also on the Wolf and the Bear on Wednesdays and Fridays, Visionary Times with Bear and the very lovely Reverend Ann Rose. That's at 1 p.m. Eastern. Also on the Wolf and the Bear on Tuesdays at 8 p.m. is Ken Quiet Hawk. His show is called Hawk's Nest. And that's a trip down memory lane that's totally addictive if you love the early radio shows of the past, as do I. His partner, Deborah New Moon Rising, has her show, and that's On My Mind with Mama Moon, and that's at 1 p.m. on Tuesdays. And then, of course, Chris, every night, 10 to 12, without fail. She's as regular as Old Faithful and is always there with interesting people and unique types of situations. She has been she has been an example of making psychics go outside the box, even though we were outside the box to begin with. And in a number of shows, we've done television roulette and done the readings from the shows that were on on the different television sets, having the person, you know, give a channel number and go to that show and then give an answer to their questions from that. They've done your standard traditional tarot and astrology and numerology and gem casting and all of that stuff, but she tends to like to be as unusual and unique as she is herself. She also has an amazing ability to give people just starting out in the field a wonderful platform to showcase their talents and for them to stretch their wings and sort of learn the ropes with a good supportive chat room and a spirit that is very supportive as well. So it's a fun place to be. It's a fun place to go and let your hair down and put your feet up, and I guarantee you'll never be bored. There are always surprises at that hour of the night. Chris herself is, I'm not going to give a long intro because I criticized the long intro she had for me, and I just I don't want to overwhelm her here. But she is an amazingly talented and gifted lady in her own right, and she absolutely is what I would say one of the finest life coaches that I have ever had the honor to meet. Even though she says she's not intuitive, I think in order to be a good life coach, you have to have that aspect of being in touch with your intuition. Though she doesn't read, she gives absolutely phenomenally good advice to people. And sometimes people don't need to have a psychic reading. They really need the life coaching even better, even more so. Because sometimes it isn't, people don't really want to know, you know, what's coming. They want to know how to deal with what they have. And I think a lot of psychics do their version of life coaching. Chris has always been able to jump in and give opinions that have been not only profound, but wise compassionate. And slightly intuitive as well. She has a manner about her that is catching, and you just can't wait to hear what's going to come out of her mouth next. Because quite often it's good for late night radio. So without further ado, hi Chris, how are you doing today?
You crack me up. I'm doing good. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, actually. And to tell you the truth, I am actually delighted that we're going to get a chance to talk because there really aren't that many people in the queue. Actually, there's no one in the queue.
I'm shocked. No one in the queue. I'm shocked. It's a tough time slot, really. It really is a tough time slot.
You know, it is, but it's also, you know, a good time slot, you know, with the weather being so nice, people are, you know, outside during the day, and to catch a show, you know, in the middle of the afternoon is not as easy as it is in the winter. In the winter, you know, nobody's outside, and so, you know, it's a fun thing, but... No, I put it up to 8 o'clock because I thought, you know, it's at least dark, so that people are going to be, you know, going in and turning on their lights. But I have been going through a lot of gnashing of my teeth and stuff like that about readers and readings and psychics and life coaching, and this is a great opportunity to kind of talk a little bit about the two. Because, you know, honestly, while life coaching, you know, I think you have to have a small amount of intuition in order to do life coaching. You know, not a lot, not enough to make you a reader, but you have to have a sensitivity to the person you're talking to.
Sure. And sure, I think that, you know, a little bit of empathy and things like this, goes a long way.
It does, and you know, for the most part, with your show and with my show, you know, you've listened to a lot of the callers that call in, and for the most part, they really do need to have the coaching more than the psychic reading.
Absolutely.
And I just don't...
I agree 100%.
And what gets me is I don't understand really why people are reaching for a psychic when really all they need is a life coach or a good therapist.
I have my thoughts on that, and it's that a psychic in these people's minds, this is not reflective of reality, in these people's minds, they want someone to give them all the answers, you know what I mean? Like they want someone to fix it all for them. With a psychic, you can call, you get to tell your sad story or whatever, get play out your drama. And someone will tell you, you know, some kind of forecast about how and when things are going to get resolved. And so then you get told the information. It's a passive thing. It's a passive thing to get a reading. To be life coached is not a passive thing. It's an active thing. You are the one that has to do the work. And so they don't want to do the work, Barbara. They just want to call around to 1,000 psychics until they get somebody that makes them feel good about it. And you know, the thing is that they might hang up the phone after hearing, you know, somebody tell them what they wanted to hear, but that doesn't make it so. And, you know, so I think of it in that way, is that people calling for psychics answers, like to the, I don't mean everything, but I mean when will my relationship or this or that or about the job or whatever, they're the ones that are engaging in the passive activity, and the other ones like they need a coach, and the ones that are prepared to do the work will go for the coach. Not very many of them, mind you.
Yeah, and well, not that I want to put myself out of business, because I sure don't want to do that, but my feeling truly is that short of mediumship is something totally different, because there you're giving confirmation of spirits that have passed over and all sorts of wonderful stuff. I mean, you can't, life coaches don't do that. But
that's right.
Almost every other situation that you know, someone calls for, the first thing almost, you know, you weave it in as kindly as you can, is that you need to take responsibility for your life.
Yep.
And if you take responsibility for your life, you have change. Lots of changes can happen, but if you continue on the pathway you're on now, that you know, take a look around. This is your reality. This is what it's going to be in 5 years, 10 years, or the end of your life. If you don't take responsibility and make changes, so that things flow differently. If you're not happy, take charge. Make changes in yourself. And you know, with the exception of that one lady that wanted to know if she was going to sell her couch, and negated every single alternative we gave her. You know, it's sort
ridiculous. You know, I look at your letter rip readings, you know, which is essentially a 1 year forecast. I would compare that to a map. I'm setting out on a trip and I get a map and I map out my thing. So your letter rip is sort of a roadmap for the next year, things to keep my eyes open for. But the point is that in the map, like if it says I have to exit at this exit ramp, you know, and then head north, I have to do that. The map doesn't do it for me, you see?
Right.
And so that's really what I'm trying to say, is like with your with your letter rip readings, it's just as critical to the process as a roadmap would be on for me driving across country to get to a specific location. And I need to know which exits to take, what direction to head, and when to do that. The rest is in my hands. And that's exactly what your letter rip readings do. And your letter rip readings are far cry from when will my boyfriend call me? You know,
well, that's true. But you know, and there have been times when somebody has called me and said nothing you said to me came true, and when you know a year later or whatever, and I usually just look at them and say, well, congratulations, you took charge of your life, you changed your pathway, and you moved in another direction.
Mm-hmm.
And they just look at me, and it's not my, you changed.
Or
you
the
changed.
Exact opposite. Or the exact opposite. The things were there, they didn't keep their eyes open, and they missed them, you know?
Well,
that's really it, you know? I mean, in a lot of people, that's the problem. Like, you know, like a psychic is not like the fairy godmother, you guys. You know, like the fairy godmother gives you a little wish and waves the little magic wand and poof, there's your chariot, you know? This is not what a psychic does. A psychic might say there's a good chance that if you do this, this, and this, you might see a chariot. You know what I mean? But like, the psychic cannot make one appear for you, period. They can't make a job come for you. They can't make a boyfriend come for you. You know, they can tell you when and where to keep your eyes open, what to look for, perhaps. The rest is up to you.
The other thing that I think people who call for readings don't pay attention to and should, and I've written it all over the place and hopefully people, you know, have read it, is that take a good look at the person you're asking to give you a reading. Are they happy? Are they joyful? Is their life in order? And if it's not, if they're not, anything that comes through them is absolutely shaded or shadowed by what they're going through in their own life. For instance, I can remember when I worked the Renaissance a very long time ago, I was, you know, just as desperate as everybody else, and I wanted to know about a couple of men in my life. You know, was one even, you know, had the potential of, you know, holding a job. Say nothing of a relationship, and so I went to one of the other psychics, and every man I talked about, she trashed. She they probably all deserved it, but she trashed everybody. Mm-hmm. And I walked away very, very sort of like holy cow, this is disgusting, this is awful, and then I realized she was going through a monster divorce. She hated men. And so no matter what man I brought up, I even named my minister, and you know, no, he'll cheat on you and whatever. And you know, it was sort of like, it made it very clear to me that if the person you're going to the reading for, if their life isn't kind of in balance, then they're not going to give you a balanced reading. And you want a balanced reading. You want one that is, you know, the person isn't just so worried about their own life that they can't focus on yours. And, I mean, you can't actually ask those questions of someone, but to a degree you can, especially with Blog Talk Radio. You can listen to how a reader is reading, and often there's an interview ahead of time, so you can actually listen to what's going on in their life. You know, do I really want to spread my guts on the table and have this person tell me what to do? And
right, and you don't, you know, and you don't, and then I had a caller last night, you know, and they were all, and the other thing, of course, is that in many cases, the people calling, they know already in their own gut what the answer is, you know what I mean? But, so I had this caller last night, and they're all, I had this reading from and the person, blah, and I didn't feel good, and I blah, 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 and I'm like, you know, like, there you go. Now, you don't have any obligation out of courtesy or anything else to do anything about that reading. You don't have any obligation out of courtesy to hear the reading out. If you are really being given a reading by somebody that is spewing negativity at you, you can thank them early and leave. You know what I mean? Like, cut. You know, you don't have to be rude about it and say, oh, well, you're no good and you stink, you know, but you can say, oh, you know, at the first earliest opportunity, thanks for your help. Thank you very much. And
well, it's even appropriate to say,
you know what I mean?
You know, it's even appropriate to say, this just isn't resonating with me, and, you know, thank you for your time. But what happens is, if you sit through the whole reading and pay for it, they have planted seeds and you have cultivated them, because you've paid for the information and you listened to it, and those seeds are planted. I think that's the one thing people don't understand. Psychics plant seeds. And, you know, good psychics plant good information and good tools, and, you know, they give you insight into some of the new directions you could go in and stuff like that. But there are people that you know, try to manipulate you. And, you know, as the older I get, the more generations of new readers I see coming up, the more and more I get upset about the fact that they don't seem to be as well trained as they used to be. They don't seem to have the polish that they used to have. They basically have intuition and a deck of cards. And not everybody, but there are tremendous numbers out there suddenly, because it is now more acceptable to be a reader. You find more and more and more people stepping in and saying, this is a cool way to make extra money. And it
or
is.
To be able to make money and not have to have an outside job. And, you know, I think it's fair. Everybody's got to start somewhere. And so if all you have is your intuition and a deck of cards, then work with it. But be honest about what it is that you are, and let people know. And that's why, you know, in my show, when we have new people coming out, you know, we talk about that they're new and they appreciate the opportunity to practice. And, you know, the ones that I get a kick out of, though, are, you know, like they're setting up a website right away and they're $100 an hour or more now, and all of a sudden they're operating with the highest vibrating energies in the whole multiverse. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the vocabulary and you know, it used to be famous or well known, and then you were world famous, and then you were globally known, and then, you know, I don't know what the
world
next step
renowned
is.
And internationally renowned, and you know, I'm all
I
like
think,
really,
you know,
like
you,
I'm I'm international too. You know, like, I mean, I've given international card readings because I sit in my living room, and somebody called me from Hong Kong, and somebody called me from, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, that really isn't what people have in their mind as international. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, you said something too the other night that I really resonated with, and I have often said it, maybe not in the same words, but something quite similar, that when people tell you how great they are, they probably aren't.
Yes. Right.
And I think that's why I shy away from that large intro, because it's so much to live up to.
Well, and, you know, and there's other tells, in my opinion, you know, and in most cases, you know, like, it's like we see some of these listeners around and whatnot, or people that we know on Blog Talk and stuff, and the first thing they have to drop in the chat room is, oh, I'm a light worker this, and I do that, and I'm a this, and I'm a that. And, you know, and that's fine if you're introducing yourself, I guess, but, like, it's every time. And so it's like almost like, are you trying to convince us or yourself, you know? And, you know, I just think that, you know, and then I love it when people, I love it. I get a kick out of it when people come in and they're newish or whatever. And they're like, I'm a Reiki master. And I'm all like, oh yeah, well, there are a dime a dozen around here. There's probably about 14 Reiki masters sitting in the chat room right now, you know? And, you know, so it's that the ones that are really, sort of walking the talk and whatnot aren't the ones that are giving themselves all these titles, labels, and telling you how great they are. They're not the same. You know, the ones that are telling you how great they are and every who they, who they train, like, you know, and all this kind of stuff. Like, their ego is already way out of control, and they're trying to make you think that they're something that they're probably not.
I know, and it's just, you know, I've run across in my time a number of those, you know, that I studied with so-and-so, and I had the Four Winds experience, and now I'm a shaman, or the newest one that I've heard lately is I go to Lilydale every year. Mm-hmm. Well, good for you. I wish that there were a way to give people a real good chart, guidelines, some way to not be snowed by people, a way that
well, and there
you know,
is, and we're gonna do that. We're gonna do a little bit of that on my show on Friday night on our roundtable.
Cool. And I've done
that topic in the past, and like the signs, things to look for, things to watch for, signs of a fraud or a fake or you know, somebody that is not on the good path, you know, and you know, how to use that discernment. And I've heard people say, oh, I'm a gifted, you know, psychic or whatever. As soon as I hear someone tell me that, like, I know right away that they're not. Because the ones that I've heard who are don't run around saying, I'm a very gifted, you know, you should be bowing at my feet, you know. And so, you know, like, and anyway, I seem to have a little bit of a built-in BS detector that works very well for me, you know, and I guess I can't say that that works for everyone else, but, you know, and so we'll talk a lot about that on Friday night's roundtable, and I'll have some resource materials and whatnot, and,
oh, great,
you know,
great.
Yeah, yeah.
It's important because, you know, I listen to a lot of psychics. I don't listen a lot, but I don't listen long, I guess is the better way to put it. And somebody said something about telling people they were going to die. And somebody just privated me and said that's not something, you know, a psychic should do. No, and the reality is there's only one person that knows when you're going to die, and that's God. And I don't think he puts out a schedule of those who are ready to lift off. You know, sometimes psychics get blown away with their own power, and people pay them money and they give them power. And it scares me sometimes. It really does. I've had a lot of people come to me that have had readings from quote unquote very famous psychics, and you know, something that the psychic had said to them really was manipulative, was judgmental, was you know, I don't want to say, yes, well, I'll say it, dark, and you know, you kind of have to, you know, try to heal the harm that they've done, and it is upsetting to me. But I want to ask you, I got off my topic here. How did you get into life coaching?
I didn't.
Okay. The tutorial is going up real fast here.
I would have to say to you that, you know, I must be innate with that, that. And I know that even as a kid, people would come to me with their troubles and this and that. And you know, I had my own set of troubles, but I think that that's what set me up to have the empathy and to understand. And I've seen a lot, right from a young age, you know what I mean? And at every stage of my life, like, when I was I did a lot of retail when I was younger, and so you are exposed to a lot of people and a lot of different behaviors from people. So, you know, I was, even when I was a young kid, like, I was busting, like I would just seem to know who was going to run off without paying for their gas, or and I will have already had their license plate number down. And then when I started at the major department store when I was like 14 years old, I caught the very first shoplifter on opening day, you know. And, you know, so I, because I became able to sort of perhaps sense or read people in that way, but it's like, what behaviors are, you know, am I looking for? You know what I mean? So the tell for me often is in the behaviors. And that's why sometimes when I'm talking to people, you know, I'll be like, well, describe, you know, somebody said something the other night or recently about, you know, their relationship. And I'm like, well, describe your relationship for me briefly, you know? Once I have a little bit to go on of what kind of behaviors are going on, then I feel that I can fairly well predict what the outcome is going to be, you know. And and then later I was a union rep and I was like representing people in the workplace, but quite frankly in that role you're not only dealing with people in the workplace, they, you know, when they're in trouble because they're late, you know, all the time or something, and now they're going to get a letter of warning or something for being late and they want to fight it or whatever. But now it's because now you talk with the person and you find out, well, there's reasons why they're late, you know, and this is where you start to see all of the other home issues that are, and other psychological issues that are affecting the person's work performance and attendance. And so it ran the gamut, you know what I mean? And I guess that I just was exposed to so many different, and then later I was a student advisor, you know? And so I guess that it's just in me, and I guess that I came here to be a helper, and it's just been a thing that I've done, you know? I do have some life coach training. I have a certificate, but I don't put a lot of stock in that certificate. I took the training online, and you work, it's self-study, and you do the modules, and then you write a, you know, you write a final exam, and then you get a certificate. So I don't lead with, I'm a certified, you know, life coach, because, you know, it's, I don't, you know, like to me, it's like an internet thing that I did. So I might have picked up a few things and stuff through that course and that program, but like, I'm not so sure that I'm any better equipped. You know what I mean? I might be better equipped to make it, give the appearance of a professional, you know, but I don't, that's not me ever anyway. You know what I mean? I like people to, I think that part of why people who do feel comfortable with me do is because I come across as I am, which is a regular, everyday, blue-collar type of person, you know? And I don't try to elevate myself to some other status and then look down upon these other people, that these poor, pathetic people that I need to help. You know what I mean? Like, to me, they're no different than me, you know? And so, you know, I have the little piece of paper, but I don't really want to, you know, put that out there. And I could have set up a website and all, you know, I am on, you know, on the organization who I took the training through, I'm listed on their website as a certified life coach and stuff like this, but I never did pursue that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but Chris, I really believe that, you know, getting book learning of any sort is is a poor excuse for anything. Life experience is a far greater quality of experience to be able to apply to situations.
Exactly.
I mean, I don't have great respect for, you know, people who have tons and tons of degrees and things like that. All that means is that they were able to pass the classes and pay the money. But apply it and grow from it and, you know, really implement it. I mean, there's nothing that you're going to learn in a book that is really 100%
Well, and the problem
applicable.
With that is that, and those people, and there are some people in this world who are able to do both, and they can walk in both worlds. So that that they can, what that they can do is that they can take what they've learned from the books, and then they can they know how to like look at it at different angles and this and that, and use it, use whatever bits of it will help in a real life situation. The straight book learner people, they're great if the answer is in a book somewhere and that they remember the answer or they know how to go and find it. But if you present them with a situation where there is no answer and now you have to use your creative thinking or your problem solving or this or that, then they're in trouble in that scenario.
Well, yeah, and the reality here too is, I mean, even if let's take for instance someone who is having relationship difficulties. Now, they probably have a chapter on relationship difficulties, and they probably have sub-chapters on, you know, the man is the jerk or the woman's the jerk or both people are on mm-hmm. drugs, and you know, but it's very rare that you will have anybody be a classic absolute to the description in the book. Everything has to be adjusted for personalities and socioeconomic standing and, you know, all sorts of other things so that truly it doesn't really you have to have the sensitivity to be able to adjust it to the situation to make sure that it works, and it only works if people are willing to work with it. When I right. did the cards, there's a poem someplace on one of the cards that says, you know, the cards are a tool and stuff like that, and they will work for you as much as you work with them. So it's you know, you are responsible to work as well as the cards, so that it's a 50-50. And I truly believe that anybody who, you know, has a situation, has a difficulty, has a hurdle that they have in front of them, they first of all, they probably charted that they needed to have that experience in order to grow. Right. And secondly, it's their responsibility to, you know, to grow from it and over it or through it or around it or whatever is appropriate, but it's their job, and sometimes you don't know where to get started, and that's where a life coach comes in, and it comes, you know, it's wonderful. But
and you know, when you understand a little bit of those other concepts like the life path or what, you know, is that's when you can start to really help, because you can start to identify, okay, there's one thing, there's a difference between this was something that, you know, that you were meant to experience, okay? But the mm-hmm. universe has a way of, if you have the same thing cropping up, you know, throughout your life, then that means, you know, that there's a good chance that means that, yes, that was something you were supposed to experience, and you haven't worked with it in the way that you were meant to. And it will keep presenting itself until you do. And, you know, so you can, you know, so that having that bit of that piece of the puzzle and then uh-huh. working towards that positive resolution of it might just be the trick to putting that one to rest so that it doesn't revisit you again. And really, yeah. one of those is the ones that are continually going through the dysfunctional relationships, or the ones, you know, like I know of a person, and this person doesn't really have trouble finding work, but they can't keep work. And there's always, I had a job and now I don't have the job no more and blah, blah, blah. And it's like that individual needs to work on those things, because most other people are having trouble finding the job, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
this person
yeah.
keeps finding jobs, but he can't keep them. And, you know, now he needs to have a coach working with him so that he can avoid whatever those behaviors are that are leading to his dismissal from these jobs.
Uh-huh. Well, you know,
until he learns that, he's going to keep experiencing.
Well, and it's always somebody else's fault. You know, it's never
right.
his fault.
Exactly.
And that's You know, but Chris, that's a hard thing to face. You know, okay, you know, I have had, you know, relationships that didn't work, and it's hard for anybody to say, gosh, you know, maybe there's something about me that needs to be changed. And,
right.
and that to, in my mind, is a terrifically mature person, one who is able to look in the mirror and say, all right, I'm screwing up somehow. Let's figure it out. Let's find out where the seed is. And it's not that I wasn't potty trained appropriately. And you know, just you know, how do I break that pattern? And that's a tough point.
And even if it's always them, it's always you, because you're getting into the situation. You know what I mean? So even if. And, like, I used to have a friend that I joked with, and I hope nobody takes offense. But, you know, this person is somebody, and they're like, you know, they had three marriages, and they were going to work on their fourth or whatever. And I'm like, you've been married three times, and, like, you've been divorced three times. Let me guess, it's always them, right? You know what I mean? And she took it well and laughed. But the goal of good coaching would be to have that person, to coach them to their own realization that it's them. But I will sometimes short circuit that process, you know what I mean? And it's like, I think it's a great gift. I mean, if you can buy somebody a couple of years of them continuing to stumble by pointing out to them, you know, in a non like, it's one thing, like, if it's, you know, you're in the middle of a divorce and, you know, of course you expect the other party to blame you and whatever. But if it's a neutral person that's pointing out to you, you know what I mean? That's a great mm-hmm. gift. And I'm willing to take the risk that somebody hates my guts, you know, because I made them look in the mirror. You know what I mean? Because in the long run, that it's going to benefit them. And that is a great gift. And I've had a few of those cases where, you know, somebody's like, oh, my God, you know, like, nobody would tell me this. And I'm sure many people around them knew it, too. But nobody would tell them, you know.
Well, you know, it's so hard, though, to really face yourself that way. I mean, I've had two divorces, and, mm-hmm. and you know, I fully will accept responsibility for half of the problem that caused the divorce. I mean, I know I it wasn't just the other person. It was that, you know, I was responsible for a lot of stuff too. And you know, absolutely. But even so, you sit back and you say, okay, I was responsible. I know what I did. What I did that enabled this to happen. How do you change that? Because you're asking a person to truly change their character.
Well, you know, when it's a bad relationship, and when I make a comment, like, if it's always them, it's still you, you know, because, you know, the women that continue to choose the abusive men, there's something in their process that they are choosing the wrong types, you know? And I want to tell those people, you know, because usually they want to go, you know, they want to go with the, usually it's looks and stuff like that. You know what I'm saying? You know, like, I ask people, write down, like, what are you looking for? You know, and then, like, when you, like, label out three different lists, and here's your first one, here's your second one, here's your third one, put down their main characteristics that attracted you to them, and then see if any of those things are similar. You know, like the suave, they know just the right thing to say and all of this kind of stuff, charming and mm-hmm. all of that, because many abusive guys are like that to begin with, you know? And mm-hmm. so if that's what you're being attracted to, then be aware of that. And I'm not saying don't ever be attracted to somebody who's charming, because there are a few people in this world who are very great people, and they also happen to be charming and have good manners and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But at least you're aware that there are some characteristics here. And then I ask a person, were any of those characteristics, if it's a female, were any of those characteristics true for your father, for example? You know what I mean? And often mm-hmm. they are, you know, and so when it's just that, I mean, that people are repeating their own patterns, and that it's not their fault that somebody's beating them up. That's not what I'm saying. It's
no,
it, 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 but, but if, early discernment of what they're getting into is in their control.
I mean, that works in that scenario, but what happens if now what a person who has been abused or a person who is a victim in the past is sending out, now we're going into my field slightly, but they are sending out an energy that is like a magnet, and it attracts people to them that are abusive. They are sending out the sort of a signal for that particular energetic, and they attract it to them. And
right.
So if you know that that's the energy you're sending out, okay, I have been a victim in the last three marriages or the last five marriages or relationships or whatever. I've been a victim. I know I am attracting people who are going to be abusive to me, whether it's physically, emotionally, or verbally. How do I change myself so I change the energetic?
Well, because that's when you start working and coaching with people to they first have to convince themselves that they have a right to not be abused, that they are a worthy human being that's equal with everybody else, and that nobody has a right to cross these barriers. We talk about establishing boundaries and, you know, that kind of thing. We talk about early warning system. So it's not don't get involved with somebody, but how many times, Barbara, you know, is it 10 years later that somebody's like, I knew it the very first time that he did X, you know what I mean? And and it's usually early on, before too many heartstrings are attached and tangled and everything. And, you know, so that what we have in those cases, we're trying to get the person's brain rewired so that they're worthy, that they are deserving of a loving partner that will not be abusing them. And many times those people are subconsciously programmed that love equals abuse, you know. And they do it because they love me, and so all that has to be undone. That all has to be undone, and that's how it has to happen.
Okay. Well, what about somebody who is who everybody in the family takes advantage of? You know, the husband takes advantage of, the children take advantage of, and to the point where they don't have a life of their own anymore. What do you do with somebody like that?
Well, you call Chris and you pay Chris $5 and Chris will say no for you, you know, but, you know, what that again is that it's boundary establishing. A lot of times these are people who, again, they feel less than, they feel like that they're the servant to, and they have been put in their head that they're being really helpful and everything else. But that's where we talk about balance and what have they done for you lately? And, you know, like that whole thing like this. And so, you know, like that's the direction I would head in with that person. And then I would get them to start with saying no to a few small things and work their way up, practice saying no. You know, I went to a women's conference one time when I was a steelworker, and there was an international women's steelworker conference. And there was a little skit that a woman put on. And because usually the ones that are having this trouble are women. And so what it was this lady is at home and whatever, and the phone rings, and, you know, the church wants her, you know, somebody else can't make their turn to work the bingo. Can she take on an extra bingo shift? She really doesn't want to, but she says yes. So what she does is she puts a coat on, okay? And then the phone rings again, and now it's the church, and they need her. Somebody else can't do their responsibility, and can she make a few extra pies for the upcoming thing or whatever? You know what I mean? She really doesn't want to. She's really overburdened as it is, but she can't say no, so she says yes. She puts another coat on. And this continues. She's got siblings, and it's the siblings' turn to take care of the parents that are aging or whatever it is. And she takes on their responsibility when she'd rather say no, and she puts another coat on. And so on and so forth. And before you know it, she has so many coats on that she can't even bend her arms to put another coat on. She can't move. She is paralyzed, essentially, by all of these extra things. So now she goes through the whole process again in reverse. That person calls and says, you know, blah, blah, can you do this? Oh, can I drop my kids off and you can babysit them, blah. She says, unfortunately, I have other plans and I'm not able to do that for you. And she takes a coat off, you see. And so each time now that she says no, she takes a coat off until she can again move, you know. And so, you know, and a lot of people, they feel like they have to give the, you know, a detailed explanation of why they have to say no. And in my overtime last night, we were talking about, you know, with Deb from Calgary, get her to do, you know, because she's really struggling financially, you know, and can't find work either. And but she does have musical abilities and things like this. And I said, why don't you set up on the Fiverr websites where you do these little things for $5, do short little jingles, you know, I'll say no for you in a song. And so, you know, what are they asking you to do that you want to say no to? Write up a witty little song, you know, a witty little jingle that basically tells the person no, and then the person can send that to the person that they want to say no to, you know what I mean? But, I mean, and that's sort of as a gag thing, you know, but the reality is that the more and more comfortable that people can get saying no, the easier it becomes for them, you know. And it doesn't mean that they never help out again, but it means that they get things more in balance. And also is to say, who would be there for you, you know, if you needed someone to look after your kids? Because often we hear these same people that are the givers, givers, givers. One thing comes up for them, and do you think that they can find anybody to take their turn or to do something for them? No.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, I'm
the key word there is helping them, coaching them to learn the word no.
Yeah, that's a big deal. I mean, it's hard to say. And but I love your analogy. That's one I'm going to work with a lot of people on, and just kind of like, you know, that redneck thing, you know, here's the sign. It's kind of like, take the coat off.
Yeah.
No,
that's right.
I think
that's right.
No, that's wonderful. I would imagine that several people out there are taking notes as you speak, because it's great advice. It's great advice. And it's tough, you know, with the economic times the way they are, so many people are under so much more stress than would normally be expected. And I guess it's just the times. And every, you know, if you went back 30 or 40 years, people would be saying the same thing about the times. Go ahead.
Well, we have so many things that are conditioned into us, Barbara. And I was thinking on something the other night, and we don't even realize that these things have been conditioned into us, these beliefs or these, that's the way things are. And here's an example that I'd ask anybody who has kids, for example, to run through. You know what I mean? So kids often mimic the parents, right? And so if a kid says to you, a little child or 12-year-old kid, thanks for pointing out the obvious. You know what I mean? Like when you go and you tell them whatever, and thanks for pointing out the obvious, Mom. Most parents will react like, don't you dare talk to me that way. That's you're disrespecting me, right? That would be a common response to that kind of thing, right? Now, they usually are saying something like that to you because you've said it to them.
Right.
Now, if that's a disrespectful thing for your child to say that to you, is it not a disrespectful thing for you to say it to your child? And why is it okay for you to disrespect your child and then slap them because they disrespected you?
Mm-hmm.
Ask yourselves that. You know, and so we get these ideas because then it's like, oh, well, I'm the adult here. Does that mean that you have a right by age to disrespect this child? Or does every human being deserve respect until they lose the, you know, until they've given reason for you to lose the respect, you know? And I think that so many people are mixed up with these ideas, you know what I mean?
Oh, gosh, yeah. And you know, it's true. I think that as a parent, sometimes we don't remember. And I know when I taught school, it always annoyed me when a teacher became an administrator because they immediately forgot what it was like in the classroom. And mm-hmm. I think sometimes kids growing up will say things like, when I have children, I'll never do this. And then, damn, they do it. And it's just amazing. I know that one of the things that I swore I would never say to my son because I hated it was because I'm the mom. That's why. And I did catch myself saying it.
Yeah.
But you know, it was one of those moments when it was almost justifiable. Not really. But
right.
I think that you have to understand as a parent or as an adult that kids, my God, they are the most fertile soil ever, and what you teach them, what you show them, what patterns you give them are what they're going to use when they grow up. And so many,
that's right.
So many parents, it drives me crazy when I hear somebody say, well, we're just staying together for the children, but we have separate bedrooms. And, you know,
right.
When the children are old enough, then we'll get a divorce. And, you know, I beg them to get the divorce now because,
yeah.
You know, basically they are telling their children, when you marry, you find someone who will live in a separate bedroom and be distant and emotionally unavailable, and that's the kind of husband you're going to look for or wife you're going to look for. And damn, that's what they do.
Even if they're sleeping in the same room, they're fighting. If there's fighting going on, we're modeling bad relationships for children who are going mm-hmm. to grow up. And I don't see that as being a favor in any way, shape, or form to that child.
Oh, my God, no. And you know, it's sort of like you are a pattern. You are the pattern they are going to pick a
yeah.
husband or a wife from. And
yeah.
you know, believe it because it's exactly what they're going to look for. And that's exactly what, you know, is going to be imprinted on their brain, and it's going to be there for the rest of their lives. Can they change it? Of course. But with therapy, with life coaching, with whatever, they're going to
yep.
have to really work on changing that pattern. And it's frightening. And the younger the child, the more impressionable they are. And here I'm talking 12 months, 18 months, 24 months. I'm talking the itty-bitties because you have to understand, and this takes it into my venue again. When a baby is born, there is a totally, fully aware spirit there. You know, it
yeah.
hasn't been shoved back and shoved down by culture, environment, teachers, parents, you know, ethnicity or religion. It's just a pure spirit, totally aware. And even though they can't talk and even though they can't move around much, you know, well, they are hearing and feeling and you're imprinting in them something that they're going to carry for the rest of their lives. So that
even when they're still in the womb, right? Even when
there's
enough, you know, so yeah, you know. And that is, and what, by the time they're 8 or 9, essentially the hallmark of their personality has been formed. And they, you know, they are, you know, anything after that is going to take some work to undo. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And,
well, I'm not sure the exact percentage, but it's something like 71% of everything they're ever going to learn has been learned mm-hmm. by the time they're 5.
Mm-hmm.
They've learned to talk. They've learned language, they've learned motion, they've learned emotion, they've learned, you know, the majority of what they're going to learn is learned before they're 5 years old. So
I mean, that's
lives,
exactly why, you know, why I was that young and cursing up a storm, and why curse words to me are just like any other word in the vocabulary. Like they're not, I use curse words as adjectives, nouns, pronouns, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, I don't have to be angry to use a curse word. I don't have to be, and in fact, people don't even usually know, like, people might notice, but I mean, like, they, you know how some people that aren't, like, usually cursers, like, they, when they're mad, then they'll say a swear word, and now that word is being said with anger. But like, I grew up with a father that spoke like that, and you know, it was funny because after I moved out of the house and I moved to Saskatchewan, I was trying to have a relationship with my parents, and so we were writing letters back and forth and stuff. And you know, my mom was telling me in this letter that they had a parakeet, and that my dad was trying to teach it to say F you. And so then I got these little visions in my mind, like, you know, like how you'll have a father like at the crib saying, say dada, say dada. And I could see my dad, you know, like saying, say F you, you know what I mean?
So I've got a story for you then. When I was growing up, when I was born, my grandfather on my father's side had an operation shortly after I was born, and he went to stay with first my aunt and then with my parents to recuperate. And when I was probably, I don't know, when did kids start to talk?
I guess
8 months,
between
9
1
months?
And 2 sometimes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, whenever that was,
yeah, I guess.
He had been trying to teach my cousin, who was 5 days older, how to talk, and he was totally worthless, still is, by the way. but he said to my mother, you know, I'll take care of Bobby, and that was one of the few times I was ever called Bobby, but I'll take care of her, you go on shopping. And my mother came back, and he was sitting there with his pipe in his mouth, smiling as broadly as he could, and he said, Bobby's talking. And my mother was thrilled. You know, it was, she got at the baby book. She said, okay, let's hear it. And he said, okay, Bobby, say oh. And I said, oh. And my mother said, that's it. He said, uh-uh, that's just the beginning. And he said, okay, what's your other word? And I said, shit. And my first words were, oh, shit. And my mother stopped
wow.
writing in the baby book. So,
There you go. But I don't know if you grew up in a house, like I would grow up in a house where, you know, like the F word was dropped all, you know what I mean? If my father was home, I was hearing the F word, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it was just a word, really. I mean, I knew that I would die a horrible death if I ever said that to my parents.
Oh, yeah.
But it certainly became ingrained in my... And nowadays I tell people, like, if I do have the capacity to try and behave and not say curse words, but a good sign that I'm comfortable around you is that I curse because I've let my guard down, you see? And you people would take that opposite usually, you know what I mean? But it's usually just a sign that I'm comfortable with you if I easily swear, you know what I mean? And I don't buy into this. This garbage.
You should come with a disclaimer.
I know, right? I don't buy into the garbage that, oh, people who curse are just so unintelligent that they don't know any other. That's not true because I have a rather high vocabulary, a high university level vocabulary. And, but why say 10 words when one word will do?
Yes, but if you say it so often, it loses its shock value.
Yes.
What's the point?
That's right.
You know?
When I'm saying it, I'm not saying it for shock value. If I'm going to say it for shock value to convey an emotion, you will know by way of my energy and the tone in my voice, you know? Otherwise, it's just a word, you know? But, you know, you can say the word love in a very angry, hate-filled way, and it becomes just as bad of a word as any other word. They're just words, you know. But the reason I brought that whole thing up was just to show how things are programmed into children, you know, at such a young age that it becomes very difficult to undo, you know?
Absolutely. And in teaching school, I saw that constantly. And there were times where things happened or children said things in the classroom that totally, you know, bowled me over. And yet when I met with their parents to talk about their inappropriate whatever, it turns out that their parents were doing it too. So it was kind of like, how do you sit down with a man and a woman and try to explain how it's inappropriate to use language or whatever, and the first, you know, five or six sentences out of each of their mouths were exactly what I was trying to correct. And it was sort of like, you know, we need to work on this because it's not acceptable in society to talk like this. Your child
What's worse is when those very same parents take the kid home and beat them for swearing. You know, because there's a failure there to realize that, you know, the behavior is being mimicked and that there's an origin. And then
it's a matter of don't do as I do as I say.
And now you're also teaching violence as a problem-solving mechanism, you know, which is a whole other discussion.
Yeah,
that doesn't
work either. But you know, it's frightening what we do to children. And it is. And often we do it because we love them and we want to help them. And how many people are just so misguided that what they do because they think it's right for their child turns out to be the wrongest thing they could do.
Well, and back to that whole respect comment, you know what I mean? You disrespect me, you know, you when you say that to me. And we're teaching kids, you know, we're teaching kids then what we're saying is, because kids aren't stupid. So if it's disrespectful for me to say that to you, then it's disrespectful for you to say that to me. If I happen to point that out to you, I'll get backhanded, you know what I mean? And that will also be disrespectful. But what we were doing, you see already, is that we're conditioning the child that it's okay for them to be disrespected, but they better not disrespect anybody else. And these are the breeding grounds for the people of the adult women, a lot of times going to be the women, to become the abused person, you know, because they aren't valued enough. They haven't been taught that they're to be respected. And they haven't been shown what respect really is.
Oh, absolutely. And what really is sad is that at some point in time, as they get older, they will learn how to hide that and how to get along in society. But that becomes the foundation of how they're going to be as an adult.
Parenting.
And they may learn to put up a front, but the reality is the person inside is I'm not going to say broken, but I'm going to say bent. And because I think anybody can fix, anybody can work on themselves and make the changes they need to make. There is nothing that can't be fixed with the proper, all right, so you can't cure a gay person. But aside from that, I mean, there's nothing that you can't change.
You can't even say it that way, Barbara, because being gay isn't a disease.
but what I mean is they don't need to be fixed because they're fine the way they are.
There's nothing broken, exactly.
But what I was trying to say is that what parents do to the children, and then the kids cover it up with whatever their peers are doing so that they become acceptable to their peers. But the foundation is right there. The foundation for their adulthood is already imprinted in the children. And it's so important to really try to give your kids a good, solid foundation. Now, if they screw up their lives, that's their problem. But you give them the foundation to work from. You don't sabotage them before they even get a chance to start. And then you look at situations like that and you think, okay, is karma coming in here? Is this something this person had to experience or whatever? And for the most part, it's not. I would like to think that karma doesn't hit till adulthood.
I don't call it karma. I call it, you know, my childhood as an example, Barbara, okay? I call that, I must have picked that, okay? And I don't call that karma. I call that my free choice, my higher self choosing a set of circumstances that were going to expose me to experiences that would put me in a position to be helpful to somebody else, for example. You know,
okay.
And like in a lot of cases, let's take addictions for a good example. A lot of places will only hire recovered addicts to be their addiction counselors, because it takes a recovered addict to know what that walk is. And so the addiction itself, you know what I mean, was a hard road for them. However, they may have chosen that in advance, you know, whatever, because that was what they needed to do for their bigger goal, which was to be an addictions counselor and maybe save a few lives, you know, and that kind of a thing. So,
well, I think that's very appropriate. My one comment that every now and then I make is no teacher should ever try to teach a lesson they haven't lived. And that goes along with the addiction stuff. I know that in my background, I have had addictions, you know, in a couple of places. I mean, all right, they were wussy addictions, but they were addictions nonetheless. I was addicted to nose spray when I was in college. I was addicted Ativan after my car accident.
Right.
Diet Coke at some point in time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All three of which I've managed to get off of. But,
right.
But you know, I know the struggle that's there. And I know that, mm-hmm. it isn't just emotional. It's also physiological. So that mm-hmm. it's not, you know, I have willpower, maybe. Maybe not. And so mm-hmm. it is a struggle. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that as a counselor, if you haven't had some form or shape of whatever the difficulty the person's going through, you don't know how to really counsel them.
The thing I wanted to point out was quickly is that it takes us back even further in our conversation, which is that, so that I might have chosen a certain set of circumstances to experience as a kid, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then those things may have preconditioned me to be an abused partner in a relationship or something like that. You know what I mean? Now the trick at hand for me is to be able to identify it, see it when it's happening, and stop it. And to stop that cycle. And so, you know, what I'm saying is that that now if I didn't know what things to keep my eyes open for, then I would be at risk of continuing to have that bad experience and that kind of a thing. And so, you know, those experiences are twofold, really, is to maybe equip you for something future in your life, but also to help you to work through what it is that got you there in the first place, and then be in a position to not allow yourself to be put in that position again, or to get out immediately if you are.
Absolutely. Well, and one of the tools that I give people is a red flag list. You know, what mm-hmm. are your red flags? What are your deal breakers?
Yep.
And I'm talking relationship here. And mm-hmm. and I make people write them down. And I make people write them down in ink and put them in their wallet and have them realize that if one of those flags appears, you walk.
Mm-hmm.
You don't say,
right.
I could live with that, I could probably deal with that, everything else is so good. Nah, there is mm-hmm. something that will become a cancer. And if you let it become
right.
a cancer, it just eats up everything. And
yeah.
I can't tell you the number of people that will call me and say, well, you know, I wrote this red flag down, but it isn't quite so bad, and I don't think I feel that way anymore. And my first question is, so who's the guy?
Well, and then that's still a person that's not in their own power if they have to call you to kind of say if it's okay if they take that off their list. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
It's never okay. If a red flag is there, it's there. I don't care how much you want to rationalize, a red flag is a red flag is a red flag. I mean, my red flag...
But it just shows me, seeing what I pick up on isn't anything to do with the red flags, but that they feel a need to go and explain to you why they're taking it off their list. They still can't...
Yeah.
A, that they already know it's wrong, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Or they would just do it and not have to feel that they have to justify it for anyone. And so they're not standing in their own power. They're not driving their own car, and that means that they're still vulnerable, let's just say. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Now they've replaced something else as a power in their life with, and that's another thing that we'll talk about with respect to psychics, teachers, and these kinds of things, gurus, whatever you want to call it, is that the ones that are making you dependent on them, they're the ones to avoid. The good ones want to equip you so that you don't need to rely on them. And, that kind of thing. So if you're replacing some other authority figure with a psychic, you know what I mean? To go and get your permission from to do things or whatever, then that's a real problem.
Oh, God, yes. And, it's funny. I read I did mediumship for a woman. She was a grandmother, and her granddaughter, who was born severely handicapped, severely. I mean, the daughter was told to abort because it was so severe, it was unbelievable, and she had the baby anyhow. Now this child, I mean, she was so severely retarded, bad word, challenged, whatever they're using these days. She lived to 13, and she was blind, and she couldn't talk, and she was in a wheelchair, and the list goes on and on and on, and there was no brain damage severely. And so when she died, the grandmother and the mother, who had dedicated 13 years of their lives to this child, were devastated. And so the grandmother came to me, and I said, okay, I can tell you where she is and who she's with and how she is. And the grandmother was just so relieved; it was unbelievable. And this is a problem that sometimes happens, and it had never happened to me before. So the grandmother would call like once a month to check on her granddaughter, and then it became once a week, and then it was two or three times a week. And I said to her, "This is inappropriate. You have become addicted to a child on the other side. You can't do this."
Mm-hmm.
And I finally said, that's it. I will not do this anymore. I said on the year anniversary of her death, come and I'll read for both of you, and we'll check in on her, and that'll be it. And they did. And then she started in again on once a month, and once I finally said to her, I won't do this anymore for you.
Yeah.
And then I was awful. I was a terrible person. I was denying
her
access to it. And it was, and all I wanted to do was to help give them confirmation.
Yeah.
And I learned that the hard way that you give the confirmation, and then you say, you can't check, you can check back a year on a yearly basis or whatever. And if they call me before that, it's like, I'm sorry, I just can't find her. I know she's over there, but she's busy.
Yeah.
And it is a very easy thing for someone to get absolutely addicted to a medium who is just, trying to give them confirmation to the point where it's a weekly visit, which is ridiculous. And I won't do that. I refuse to do that. But there are people that do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not and there's many out there that will take advantage, and they're not even all that connected. They're just using generalities and whatnot, and enough to make the person think that they're connected, and they're really probably not even connecting, but they'll take their money week after week,
Well, and the thing is, people get the wrong idea to the other side. I mean, a spirit goes to the other side, and there's a party and stuff like that. And they do go through a time in which they sort of do a review of some sort. And then they start on their spiritual work, and they start to lose their density, and they become more and more and more spiritually oriented. And over a period of time, they become more focused on their spirit development and what they need to do. And at some point in time, they decide to come back down here because they need to gather more information and experience. They're working over there. They're not just fishing and having barbecues. They're working. And while there is no time frame there, they aren't, just sitting watching TV and seeing what's going on down here. They have a life.
Yeah.
And for us to intervene or us to try to tap in or us to, you know, play peeping Tom on a regular basis is inappropriate. You open a portal,
yeah.
A spirit comes in, they talk a little bit, they go back to whatever it is they were doing. But they're not waiting for portals to open so they can stick their heads through and say that, you know, the safety deposit key is in the right shoe of my, you know, patent leather shoes. You know, they're
I think that if they want to come through, that they do and they can. And I know that there's a perfect example is when Renee Richards was boxing up some selenite wands for me that I had won on her show. She wrote me an email and said, "Kay, I got your package off into the mail. I had, your grandmother and this other fella here with me, blah, blah, blah." Like, so they showed up all by themselves. Like, nobody was calling on them, you know what I mean? And then in which case, that's fine. And I've heard many examples of mediums, you know, passing on along and saying, "Oh, hey, and, such and such is here to say hi to you," or whatever, you know? And so, but that, you're right, is different than pestering them. It's like, you know, "You didn't talk to me this much when I was alive. Why won't you leave me alone?" You know what I mean?
That's very, very true. That's very true. Yeah. We do have a couple of callers, so we will take those calls. But it's
awesome.
it's really delightful to sit and talk with you, to be honest with you.
It's a great conversation. Great conversation.
Okay. We've got Rita in California. Hi, Rita. How are you doing?
Fine. How are you ladies tonight?
We're having
Hi,
an
Rita.
Actual good time, actually. How can we help?
It's hot here in California. We're having a heat wave.
Oh, please.
So anyway, plants are all dying. But anyway, but I'm not. I'm still here.
Oh, good.
Okay. Question. I spoke with the district attorney today who packaged up my case and taking it to the, walking it into the DA, hand delivering it, and the DA will review it and either say yes or no.
Okay.
Say that one more time for me.
I spoke with the district attorney, and I had filed with the police department something that occurred, and I'm wanting prosecution, criminal prosecution, so I'm asking for it. And so they have to package it up and present it to the district attorney, who will either say yes or no or whatever.
Gotcha, yeah. And you want to know if they're going to go ahead and pursue the case for you.
Yes.
I'm not seeing them pursuing it. Why were not the police involved?
Why were the police involved?
Why were they not?
Well, you know, why were they not involved? I reported an incident to the police department. That's why the police are involved. And so they have to package it up and present it to the district attorney. So I filed a incident report with the police.
That kind of says to me that the police didn't really want to pursue it themselves, but they're going to go ahead and send it to the district attorney and let the DA be the one to make the decision on whether to pursue it or not for pressing charges for, yes? Because oftentimes lots of times if to have the police charge the person with any crime.
Well, that's where they're going to the district attorney. And then
right.
The district attorney
and what I'm
will...
saying, yes. And what I'm saying is oftentimes if there's enough for the police, they'll just go ahead and press the charges and pass it over. Okay? And so to me, what it's saying to me is that the police aren't feeling it and that they want to abdicate all responsibility for the decision and give it up all over to the DA to tell you yes or no. That tells me the police aren't really that on board with it.
Is this sexual harassment?
No.
Okay. I've got the cards out here, and I'm not seeing this going through. And of course, you know, it's cards and stuff. So don't take this as carved in stone, please. But it feels to me as though the district attorney is going to decide not to because there are too many loopholes. And I keep seeing loopholes. I keep seeing all sorts of... I'm seeing Swiss cheese, so there are a lot of holes. I'm seeing moth holes. They're giving me all sorts of visuals of things with holes in them. And so I think that this is not a firm enough, stable enough case, as it were. And they won't... I don't think that they'll follow it through because they usually like to have a fairly... They have to be fairly confident about the fact that they can make something stick. Otherwise, it's a waste of the city's money. So,
they want to talk to me?
Well, who want to talk to you?
The DA.
The DA talked to me.
I mean,
yes, because
I would think
asked
that
the detective.
They. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would think that now, am I right in the fact that the police have the police sort of said to you they don't think there's enough evidence
No, I gave them all sorts of evidence. I gave them the proof. I gave them a bunch of stuff.
Well, lots of times
of stuff.
We think we have proof, but what we think is proof is a different standard than what the courts are going to determine as being proof. You know what I mean? And for whatever the crime is. But, like, I guess I'm saying to you is that usually for cases that the police are on board with, they go ahead and press the charges, you know. I did pull a rune for you, and I got the blank rune. And the one thing that was sticking out to me in the descriptor for this one is that that there's something hidden from view, and that sometimes it represents a secret that has to remain secret for your own good. And so, I don't know what you can take, you know, we don't know what any of the circumstances are, so if you can take that and apply it in any way that is useful, then that's great. If not, let it toss it to the wind and let it go.
Yeah,
there's something out of view. It's a secret?
Yeah. It says basically that there's something hidden from view. And sometimes it represents a secret that must remain a secret for your own good. But the key here is like that something is hidden from view. Something isn't, you know what I mean? Something is hidden from view. So I don't know what the deal is. I don't know what the, you know,
yeah,
I don't
and,
know what,
and I,
what your case is. Or
yeah, and I'm getting the feeling that whoever or whatever it is that you're looking for prosecution from has more power than you anticipate, and therefore I think they will not do it. They will not go ahead. Okay? And that's
okay.
Just what we're getting. That's just, when is this all happening?
Well, I talked to him today, you know, and I had met with him, and I gave him all kinds of legal documents and proof, like a deposition. I had documentation from the insurance company. of deceit and deception. So his deposition is under oath, and we had subpoenaed in a civil case documents from the insurance company. So I have very good proof, and so he said that, you know, he's going to walk it in. I said, well, you know, maybe I have something. I just don't, you know, if there's like a missing piece to the puzzle, ask me. I may have it. So I would like to talk to him, or, you know, him or her, whoever it is. He said it would have to go through a special
prosecutor?
Yeah.
Yes, it would have to go through a special prosecutor.
Coming from a family of lawyers, up the wazoo, I might add, a lot of times what you're asking to do is just not allowed legally. And so I think I truly, from what I'm feeling here, I truly believe that while you may well have a case, it isn't legally sustainable, so I don't think they'll follow through with it.
They also, since you mentioned that, it's also taking down the avenue of civil. Lots of times, like, whichever one goes first, so if a criminal prosecution starts, then a lawyer goes on standby on the civil matter and does nothing until the completion of the criminal case, and then vice versa. So if this is already in the works with a civil matter and not to its completion, then chances are that they would be reluctant to do much until the completion of the civil. Why would I say that? Because let's say that you can show in the civil matter that there was wrongdoing. The standard of proof is different in a civil court than in a criminal court. In a civil court, they only have to show that in the balance of probabilities, it's more likely that this person did this bad thing. In a criminal court, it has to be beyond a reasonable doubt. And so that's how come lots of times you'll see a case succeed civilly and fail criminally. And that might be the gray area that your case falls under. But I don't think that if there's already a civil case commenced, I think that, you know, that the criminal case will sit on the back burner until the completion of the civil case. Just a guess.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks for calling. I hope we didn't confuse you totally.
Okay. Well, thank you, Barbara. Thank you, Chris.
Good luck.
Okay.
Isn't that what happened with OJ? Didn't he?
Yeah.
He won the criminal, and he lost the civil. And he lost the civil. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see if we can be a little more explicit for Anna.
And quite frankly,
Anna.
That's a perfect example, because if the criminal prosecution hadn't rushed so quickly, there's evidence that came out through the civil trial that actually ultimately proved the case, which is like the Bruno Maglio shoes and things like this. And it was simply a passage of time for that evidence to surface. And with that evidence, he would have probably been convicted in the criminal court. But anyway... Hi, Anna.
He ended up in jail anyhow. Hi, Anna. How can we help you?
Well, I'm thinking about moving out of my current apartment by the end of the month, but I'm just wondering, do you see me staying here or finding something less expensive or ending up with a roommate or, you know, family, living with family? I'm just wondering what you see.
Okay, let me get this straight. You have to move by the end of the month?
Well, I don't have to. I don't know. I've put in my notice, and I've been looking around. I'm just wondering what you see coming out of it.
I'm not seeing you moving.
No.
No, it feels like you're going to stay there another year, and then I see a move. But you haven't found anything you really liked, have you, that you can afford?
No, I guess my landlord's here. I mean, I've been a really good tenant. I just feel like they're kind of expecting me to take care, and my neighbor to take care of the place like we own it. And I was a little frustrated with that. The gas bills were really high during the winter. And so I decided you know, to put my notice in and see what's out there. I was going to go back and live with relatives, but I'm having weird thoughts about that.
There's so much insecurity around you. There's so much, you know, if and that, and, you know, seesawing stuff. This is the wrong time for you, it feels, to make a decision as major as this. It doesn't feel like you're balanced. It doesn't feel like you're stable. And, you know, it's when in doubt, don't. So that it's really important for you to kind of get your feet under you and come to a better balance. And it does feel like by the time you hit December, there is a better balance. And, you know, certainly look around. I wouldn't have put notice in unless you had found something. I'm pretty sure that you will be able to stay there. And to be honest with you, you know, the cost of gas has gone up everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So,
have you discussed this concern with your landlord?
I haven't gone into detail with it with her.
So here's the life skills sort of a thing for me to say. If you have an issue with something, before you go away from it, you at least raise it with, you know, so you're frustrated with the landlord, they expect too much of you, blah, blah. So you go and approach the landlord and say, and take your other neighbor or whatever, if they're affected in the same way, and say, here's how we're feeling. We're feeling like we are saddled with more responsibility than a tenant should be, and that we feel that we should get a break on our rent or cost sharing of the utilities as a result of that. Now you're giving him an opportunity to say no. If he says no, then now you have a decision to make, and the ball is in your court. You either accept the way it is, which, you know, so I would have first, before I put notice in, said, you know, is there any way we can talk about, you know, this situation because we're a little bit frustrated on this? And if not, say, Levy, you know, and you don't necessarily start tossing around, I'm going to put my notice in and move then or whatever, but you know, but like, I just always think that, you know, first we owe an obligation to a person to let them know what is bothering us and what it would take to make us feel better in that situation. Because there's a benefit to the landlord by keeping people that have already proven themselves to be good tenants, because it's less of a worry on the landlord's head of who's moving into my property, you know? And so there's a benefit on that end to having a good tenant, you know? And so now there's some negotiating room for you, perhaps. I'm not sure. I did pull a rune for you, and the rune I pulled was bliss and glory. And so it talks about, you know, that there should be happy results and harmony and prosperity. And so that led me to think that, you know, I wonder if she's even talked to the landlord about her concerns. And that doesn't mean that I'm telling you that he will open up his wallet and give you all his money. But, you know, it's at least worth negotiating.
Yeah, I did, you know, I guess a couple times I did ask her if she could help us with certain things, like having the salt for the water sink system delivered and bill us back in the rent, and she said no, and we have to go and pick it up ourselves, and, you know, and this and that. It's a lot. But I guess my other thought was maybe going to live with my step-parents and trying to save a little money. I mean, I'd be paying them rent, but I feel like a little, not as much, but I feel like a little torn that, you know, I'd be losing my privacy and, you know, a little independence by doing that. So
all of the descriptors that go with the rune that I pulled are peace, pleasure, self-worth, joy, serenity, happy results, harmony, prosperity, an undertaking with happy results, okay? And so you're the one that's in the, you know, you're the one in the driver's seat. So take all of those things into account and go ahead and make a decision. Still doesn't mean that, you know, something's not going to pop up that's a great place for you to go move into where you can save a few bucks and still maintain your you know, privacy and everything else, your independence, you know. But you know, all I'm saying to you is that if you give careful consideration and understand that all these decisions are within your jurisdiction, then, you know, if you follow through with all of those things in your mind, it should be an okay outcome.
Okay.
Take control.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Thanks, Anna. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You know, again, you know, instances of, you know, let me run away instead of dealing. And,
right.
And Lord knows I've done that a lot.
And sometimes it's good. Sacrifice for a year. And that's what I tell some people is I go, like, you are making yourself broken in debt by maintaining a lifestyle you can't handle financially. But I need my private bouquet. So short-term pain for long-term gain. Give up some of those things for a period of time that will help you to get the balance sheet in the right order and get a little bit of money in the bank, and then you're in a better position to have that independence you've been looking for. And so, you know, like, you have to weigh all of these things, and sometimes it's the way it has to be. And you know what, like, nobody promised you a rose garden, and but if you have somebody that you can move in with, you have more than a lot of people have.
Oh, my,
you know,
God, yes.
And if that can help you get some money in the bank so that you're in a more stable position to go out and find a more desirable living situation, then it's been worth that sacrifice of the year, you know, that you put up with.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, a question, you know, to really answer for yourself is, okay, so, you know, saying I lose my privacy, you know, is one thing. But, you know, what do you do with your privacy? I mean, you know, you're not sleeping in the same room with them, so you don't have to live with their snoring. Because I moved back with my mother, and, you know, I said to somebody once, well, yeah, but, you know, I lost my privacy. And they said, well, what were you doing with your privacy? And I stopped to think, and it was like, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right.
It was, you know, my privacy. What was, I think the only thing that I could come up with that was really privacy is that I couldn't bring somebody home to sleep in my bed with me. I could still go out and sleep. I could still go out and sleep in somebody else's bed, but, you know, I couldn't bring them into my home. But that was the only part of the privacy that you know, I was
and it probably
missing.
Wasn't something you were doing every weekend anyway, right?
No, I wasn't. I wanted to be maybe, but, you know, it was kind of like, it was sort of like, okay, so, you know, okay, I have my own phone line, so they're not answering my phone. I have my own room and my own television and my own computer. Mm-hmm. And she was buying the food and paying the mortgage. So, you know, the only privacy I was losing was having, you know, she was hampering my capability of being a slut. That was it.
Yeah. Which might have been actually a benefit in the long run. You know, it might have protected you from inviting the wrong person home.
No, that's all right. I married them, you know, so.
That's funny.
but seriously, privacy. I mean, come on. What do you do privately? I mean, lots of people do lots of things privately, and I don't have to know what they are. But you can shut a door and have privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, for the most part, that's all you need is a door you can close. And you know, if you want to say to people, you don't go beyond this threshold, I'll clean it and I'll take care of it. Mm-hmm. That's fine too. And you create your boundary, and there you are. And so, anyhow, I wanted to just, you know, we don't have a lot of time left. I wanted to go into UFOs with you.
Okay, well, let's do that. And I will leave about, you know, 5 minutes early or something, because I have to, and I'll leave the chat room sooner so I can open my own chat room. But I will give myself about 5 minutes leeway to open up my switchboard and stuff like that for my show.
Your coffee and everything. I understand.
Well,
the coffee's made.
The coffee's made, so I'm good to go there.
Actually, I just checked, and while we may not have a lot of people here, actually, listeners, we've got a lot of them. So that apparently there are people listening that didn't want to be in chat room or call in, but there's a lot of people out there listening. So,
woohoo!
Yeah, woohoo! Well, hey, listen, when I opened the chat room, it was just me and one other person and then you, and all we needed was a fourth to play bridge.
Yeah.
But UFOs are something that comes and goes. It's almost like, and they're starting to come again. I'm starting to see all sorts of things on Facebook and on YouTube and things like that. The UFOs are becoming to be are more and more frequent, and people are beginning to talk about UFOs again, but in a different way than they used to. You know, it used to be, you know, I'm afraid of the extraterrestrials, and now it's could they land in my backyard and have a barbecue with me? And you know, it's I'm fascinated with how we have gone from being afraid of aliens, those from another planet or galaxy or whatever, to almost welcoming of visitations of some sort. And I'm wondering if maybe the whole process has been getting the public ready to be more agreeable and more embracing of the fact that we, you know, maybe are going to have contact. We are maybe going to see that, you know, there are extraterrestrials out there. And I'm wondering what you're feeling on it.
Well, you know, and I think that there's still a fair share. The funny thing is that, you know, there's the fair share of the conspiracy people who are all, you know, like up in it, like that the don't be tricked, that the aliens are on our side and all this kind of stuff, you know. And like, I'm just saying, like, if they wanted to poof us, they'd have poofed us a long time ago before we destroyed the whole planet. You know what I mean?
Oh, sure.
And I'm not, like, I often say, like, if I was alone on a desert road, you know, and a car pulled up and the mothership pulled up, I would think I would go with the mothership, you know, like if I had to pick one or the other. Like I don't trust people so much anymore, you know what I mean, as strangers, you know. And I'm not worried. I'm not. Now, would it freak me out if I opened my eyes and there was a gray 3 inches from my face? Yeah, it would probably freak me out, you know what I mean. And I believe that it'll be done a little more gently than that, you know what I'm saying. And although that I'm not so convinced that I haven't had some ET visitation myself, I can't say that I have, you know, been beamed up to the mothership or anything. And if I had, I have no, no recollection of it. But I'm left with all kinds of other clues that tell me that there's great chance that I've had ET contact. And so I believe, just like with people, that there's good and there's bad among any group. You know, that would be aliens, you know, any group. Any group of people, any nationality of people, any same nationality or how should we say race of aliens. And so, but I do believe, Barbara, that a lot of the stuff that, you know, that even all the way back to, you know, the 70s, you know, has been to condition us slowly. You know what I mean? And I sometimes wonder if a lot of these more comprehensive scripts for some of these movies and TV shows aren't being somewhat channeled. You know what I mean? And,
oh, absolutely. Well, look at Star Trek.
So,
look at Star Trek.
Yeah.
The doors that opened and shut for them, you know, that was really cool. Now in every mall, they open and shut for you. The tricorders, you know, our cell phones.
Yeah.
You know, we're even beyond the flips. You know, so much of it is something that you know they've predicted what was coming in the future. And you know, I've listened to your show enough to know that you have aliens on there. So
you know, and I'm not one that necessarily believes that there's going to be 1,000 ships in our sky. You know what I mean?
No.
Descending on us. Like, I believe that the vast majority of travel is happening through teleporting. You know what I mean? Like, I honestly believe that. And,
oh yeah, it has to be interdimensional. I was on a show, a UFO show a while back, and a guy was talking about, you know, how it's impossible to go to some planets and stuff because they wouldn't be able to store enough food, the cans would rust, and I'm thinking, have you looked at our technology these days? You know, they don't send cans up into space anymore. I mean, for God's sakes. No, I think they're teleported. It's interdimensional travel. I don't think that there's a big ship that goes. I think a vessel interdimensionally travels. That's how crop circles are made. It's a flash in and a flash out. That I believe that's how stuff happens. Now, that's just my opinion, you know, and who am I? I mean, of course, Patrick was a big expert in this field, so. And actually,
like,
he died.
Let's face it, parking is a hassle as it is over here on Earth. You know what I mean? Like,
this is true.
For
this
that
is
reason
true.
Alone.
Well, I do believe though that there are, and of course the term alien means just not indigenous to this planet. It doesn't mean they have antenna and, you know, three heads. They could be humanoid or not, but the I would think, because I go back to the pyramids and stuff like that down in South America, those steps were not made for human feet. They were made for another species. So it says that they've not only been here, but they've helped in places, they've hindered in places, they've taken sides in places. So the more I look into all of this, you know, people are talking about, you know, these are our creators, but the reality is these are just another step in the hierarchy of aliens or extraterrestrials out there. They aren't God. Something made them, and something made them, and something made them, and something made them.
You know, and I still entertain in my mind, Barbara, that it's entirely possible that because past, present, and future, like if we look at physics, past, present, and future, there is no time, blah, 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 everything happens at once, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm still leaving open in my mind that these ETs are, you know, offshoots of us in the future, you know, and, you know, and through time rips and everything else like this, we periodically have interaction or sightings of them, you know. I leave myself open to that as being possible. You know, one day we will have destroyed this earth, you know, and we will have, either found a way to escape Earth and settle elsewhere, or we won't have. You know what I mean? Or some of us have, and then gone on to, you know, to perhaps interbreed. And I believe that some of that has gone on already, you know, like all the way back to the giant stage, you know. I believe that was alien intervention into the, and that, additional DNA was put into the human beings, and that all of the descendants from those human beings, you know what I mean? Because there was no explanation for the rapid growth of the size of the brain, which had been an extreme departure from the rate of growth of the human brain to that point in evolution. And so then all of a sudden there was this huge spike in the growth of the brain. And to me, that spells alien intervention.
Oh, I'm right along with you on that one. But I don't think we're an experiment. I think we are, we could be a mistake. We could be a bastard child. We could be a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that you know, I the Ancient Alien series, of course, I'm familiar with because Patrick was on it, and it just, you know, I'm not sure yet that we have it right, and I don't think we ever will have it right, because there's always going to be another level to uncover and a new stretch for evolution and all sorts of stuff like that. But it is I'm encouraged in that it isn't so negative. They aren't you know, pegging the extraterrestrials as monsters who are coming to take all of the gold for their atmosphere and stuff like that. I think that happily, humans are becoming a little more savvy into, you know, the aspect of the fact that there are extraterrestrials, because let's face it, the people that we've sent to the moon became extraterrestrials because they were on a planet that it was not indigenous. And if we go to Mars, we become the extraterrestrials.
That's right.
It's gonna be interesting to see how it is coached, and you know, the government has hidden so much from us. I don't know if there has been you know, any sort of communication with another species or otherworldly, creatures. I know for sure. I can carve it in stone and guarantee it that if indeed there is contact of some sort, it will not be to major governments. It will be to the entire planet at the same time, and probably telepathically.
Yeah. Well, I for one absolutely look forward to meeting my galactic brothers and sisters. And I hope it happens in this lifetime, and it may not, you know, I mean, in a grand global way where there's actually, you know, this interaction between us, you know, that's of a productive and sometimes not productive, you know, because that's how people are. That's how we are. We cannot get along with everybody. You know, I worry about who we send as our ambassadors, you know, to the scenario.
I forget who it was that said it, but they said that the only way the Earth would ever, you know, work together as one would be if there was a threat from, you know, outer space. And,
right.
You know, I do believe that. I do believe that was accurate, but I don't think it's going to be a threat. I mean, unless it's an asteroid coming straight at us or something like that. It's we've grown so far apart, just you know, culturally and economically and religiously, that it's frightening. And the thing is, we are a family of man. That means that we're all related. That means that we're all connected. And to divide ourselves into all these little different areas and elements is frightening. In that, you know, we're all alike. You know, you take the skin off and, you know, we're the same skeleton, the same organs for the most part. And, you know, when you cut us, we do bleed.
Yeah.
So it's horrible that people put themselves above or apart from others. You know, we're all one race, and you, there's no
well,
there's
and
no
us as human beings, we also do that with what we understand as the alien race. You know, like we are, like the reptilians are bad and the Pleiadians are good, and you know what I mean? Like there's this hierarchy that we because I don't know what it is about the human that has to put everything above or below something else. Using ourselves as the, you know, and like I was thinking about this last night, and I got to be quick because my show's going to start in a minute, but, you know, is that we can't even get like a group of, you take any race even, okay, and there's discrimination within that race. Take even into a smaller thing. Go into a hospital, and there's discrimination among the workers in that hospital. You know, the indigenous culture here in Canada, the Inuit don't care too much for the First Nations, and the First Nations don't think the Métis people should have rights. And among the Métis people, you have, well, you're an Indian-looking Métis, so you have credibility, but you're a white-looking Métis, and so you're not as good as us. You know what I mean? And like, there, it just drives me crazy. But on that, I have to fly.
Okay, you go fly, and thank you
so
for a
thank
great
you
show.
So much. It was an awesome
pleasure.
Discussion, and I appreciate it. Take care, Barbara.
I'll see you later. Bye-bye. I want to thank everybody for being here. This has been a cool show, and I always love it when I get to talk to people, because, you know, so often it's read after read after read after read, and this show has been delightful because I was able to actually talk to Chris. And I think the cool thing about her is that she's not just pretty face. She's got an amazing mind, and she absolutely holds up, you know, her end and more of a conversation, and she has a lot of really cool, wonderful things to say about a lot of cool, wonderful things. So do tune in on her show, to her show on Friday. Sounds like it's going to be a great one. And those of you who are not totally exhausted and want to go to bed, hop over to her show. It's Curious Times. I promise you it will be exciting. She has an amazing lady named Jen Young who's going to be on, and I'm proud to say that she found Jen Young on my show. So hop over. Thank you so much, everybody. It's been a pleasure, and I will talk to you tomorrow night, another show tomorrow night, 8 p.m. Looking forward to it. Take care now. Bye-bye.